This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'm going to mix a little bit of a discussion of the immune system, notably the immune system that you probably don't know about. Many of you know about the immune system as the thing that protects you against pathogens and viruses. And when you get a shot in the arm, a vaccination, you're essentially, we all understand that you're teaching your immune system about something that's foreign and dangerous so that you can respond to it later. For example, the flu virus or a flu vaccine or measles vaccine or any of the things you had as children. And what's unique about the immune system, obviously, is it remembers. So, you know, you had a vaccine when you were a kid, and many of you are still protected by that vaccine right now. So we all understand that about the immune system, but I'm going to sort of try to teach you a little bit about some of the hidden unknowns about the immune system and the things it's doing in disease. But I will focus a lot on the cancer story because it's a little illustrative of what we can do using the immune system and what we now understand of it. So I'm going to do that a little bit through the lens of how my lab studies the biology. So I'll have a little bit of science, you know, real science-centric talk and then try to get into the basic fundamentals. I'm assuming that will hit everybody just about right. So my view of the immune system starts by studying how things take place in real time. And so there's a Yogi Berra quote that says, you know, it's amazing how much you can understand by just watching something. And so we watch things at the level of individual molecules. This is a density diagram of an immunoglobulin. This is a molecule on the surface of an immune cell. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we image through microscopy individual cells. We're going to learn a lot about these cells called T cells that are the green guys here interacting with some of their partners here in the red. And I'll show you a movie of that in just a moment. My lab also looks into arrays of cells. So this is a developing breast carcinoma. This is a ball of tumor cells in black here that you're not seeing. But all the green and yellow and red and blue cells around that are your immune system. So your immune system is really omnipresent. It's in all your tissues right now, surveying you, getting to know you. It's kind of like another brain that you have. And ultimately, you know, the way that I tend to view things is that small things give rise to slightly larger things. Small, you know, cells then get together to make tissues. And the tissues at some point and how they function determine very important things like whether you live or die. So this is the response of melanoma patients to a drug that we made over at Berkeley some years ago. And you see people that are living out now to 15, 20 plus years that are cured. And then the second round of those drugs, about 50% of people I should mention that in this particular drug, the patient population normally dies within 6 months. So, you know, you're seeing about half the people are cured. And so that's a really big change from about 5 or 10 years ago, and it's a large part due to our understanding of the immune system. So that's good. So I'm going to show you this movie. It's a little bit of a rendering of an interaction of two immune cells because it demonstrates something that I think is really important biology, right, at the biology level, is the concept that your body works because all your cells are agreeing with each other. They're coming together purposefully to tell each other information. And really your immune system is about information. It's saying this thing is foreign, this thing is myself. And we'll talk a little bit about this idea about who everyone in this room is immunologically. You know, you are a collection of the cells that were derived from your parents, as a single egg that have now become quite diverse, both in terms of their function, but each one is also mutagenized under the influence of the sunlight, for example. And so your body is quite a mix of, you know, your identity is quite diverse. And then, of course, you have the microbiome, too. You're all colonized with bacteria, as you probably think we'll learn in one lecture. So if you watch this movie, this is a very high-resolution image that we take, where the T-cell here, you know, normally if you look in a normal light microscope, would be kind of a round ball. And you'll see things in, you know, magazine articles where the immune system is like that. But if you watch this movie, you'll see that this T-cell has a lot of these little, I call them microvilli, these sort of finger-like projections, and they probe the world, and they're actually looking to find stuff. They're like, it's like when the doctor palpates your stomach trying to feel things. Essentially, T-cells will do that. Meanwhile, the cell on the other hand is actually going to meet it halfway. So this rotates just to give you a sense of this contact. There's a round T-cell, or more or less round, with these little projections, and you can see how these are kind of palpating the world at large. Right now, you can't see this interface, but we're going to break it away for you here because we collected the data in such a way that you can show that. And you can see how these little fingers are pointing out to try to find stuff. But meanwhile, this cell has extended itself down to be seen. I'm not sure if you caught that, but essentially the cells are complementary. You know, it's not that one cell is a flat surface and then one is probing it. Both cells have kind of made this attempt to communicate, and they've really made this sort of attempt to handshake. And that's a really important feature of the immune system, is it's trying to convey information about what all it's seeing in various different ways. So primarily tonight, I wanted to focus on this idea of how many, many cells working together create the biology that is really health and disease, and again, focusing on the immune system. And I'm going to do that in the context of cancer. So many of you understand, I think, the idea of cancer. Fundamentally, it's shown here as within a tissue, a collection of these very red, angry, bad cells, which are cells that have gone rogue. Normally, all the cells in your body have some sort of rules about when they can divide and when they can repopulate. Maybe they, you need to repair if you scratch your skin or something. But what happens in cancer is you get cells that don't obey the rules anymore, right? So they've become a little bit more like a free colony. And in the past, we thought, okay, well, let's target that. And so until about 10 years ago, almost all the drug industry, all the sort of intuition said, well, let's just figure out how these cells are doing that, and let's target that pathway. Let's target that feature of them. Maybe they've lost control because of a particular gene that they've turned on or the gene that they turned off, so let's make a drug against that. But what that lacked in insight was the idea that tumors are mutating. The reason they got to be this way is because they've changed themselves, and they're constantly in a state of change. And so if you drug one aspect of them, they'll just change that, right? So that's been the experience of chemotherapies, and that's why you hear about people going back into remission and then coming, and having a recurrence of their cancer. Is that at some point the cancer gets smart or it gets lucky and it mutates so that the drug no longer works, and then of course you're in trouble again. But if you look at the tumor as a whole, there is, in fact, the red cells that we think of as these angry cells that are doing all the things I just mentioned. But always, and we've always recognized this, but we didn't really understand it, they're always surrounded by a group of cells that are actually immune cells. There's cells of your white blood cell system that you think, you have blood drawn. These little green cells here are a kind of white blood cell called T cells. And these kind of star-shaped cells I'll tell you about later are cells that are called macrophages and dendritic cells. And even now, as I'll show you in some movies, your body is being patrolled by these cells all the time. So all tissue has some of these around them, but tumors have quite a few. So tumors actually recruit the immune system to provide them with protection. So I'm going to show you a little bit of a movie that we take in the lab, and this is actually a mouse mammary tumor. This is equivalent of what's called luminal B breast cancer in humans. The black space, again, we're not actually highlighting the tumor at all. What I've got highlighted are two kinds of immune cells in green and yellow, and then the purple is actually blood flowing around these. So normally the ducts in mammary, flow, like they branch and they produce milk to give to children. But in the case of cancer, those ducts fill up with balls of tumor cells, and then they eventually break out. This is the point where you have balls of tumor cells within the ducts. And so many, many ones are filling it in many spots here. So as you watch this movie, I think this is sped up. The actual real time is shown down here. Roughly 100-fold faster than it normally will. But I think you get the sense that this is a really active community. The tumor is all the black. We're looking only here at the immune system that is part of the tumor microenvironment, the environment that surrounds the tumor and gives it life. And again, we'll come into what some of these cells are. I'll play this movie for you a couple other times and a few others to take the drive home. But at this point, I just want you to recognize the idea that there is an immune system, and the green cells and the yellow cells are two different cell types, and that they have different functions and different activities, and just maybe absorb that. Okay, so what are they? So I'm going to give you four or five slides to introduce you to the players of this, and maybe some of you will have seen this when you go to the doctor and you have a whole blood cell count. But some cell types that I want to give you some names to. So we named the tumor, as the cell I showed you here is red. They were the black spaces in those movies that I showed you. So cell here, this is a shorthand for macrophage. Macro meaning big, from and Greek, and then phage, eater. So this is a big eater. We also call them sometimes phagocytes, so cells that eat. We'll talk about two kinds of what are called lymphocytes, B cells, and T cells. And T cells come in various flavors, and we give them names once in a while that are a little bit more confusing. But these are CD8 T cells, cytotoxic T lymphocytes. So you have all very, we like to confuse people, but ultimately these are all called lymphocytes. And then similar to macrophages, there's variations of cells that are macrophages called, for example, dendritic cells. And then most tumors are also surrounded by some element of the tissue that they originally came from, that they're breaking out of. So we often refer to that just as stroma. So this purple border that I'm drawing here maybe might have been the original barrier of the duct, for example, and then the tumor growing within there. So that gives you a little introduction, but I'm going to go into two particular component cell types that I need you to understand to sort of see how the immune system works. And this comes to the fundamental question I asked in the earlier, like, who are you? You know, what is yourself and who are you defending against? You know, when you're thinking about the world at heart. And I want you to maybe change that a little bit through the course of the night where you say, maybe a little bit, this will be political, sorry, I'll say this, but, you know, like the little anti-Trump here would be to say that, we are a community that accepts, immigrants into our world and we make peace with them. And that's actually how societies are generally, they generally function. The immune system actually has more of a role to do that than to defend you against things. In other words, it's much safer and it's much easier to be at harmony with the world outside, the bacteria that are on your skin or in your gut, than it is to be constantly fighting with them. Because if you're fighting with them all the time, you're in constant state of inflammation and you have a tendency to damage yourself. And so there's a lot of diseases the immune system associated with overzealous response to the world outside you. And the world outside really is the world on you. You have a lot of bacteria on your skin, you have a lot of bacteria in your guts. Gut, for example, about 10 times more bacteria in your body than you have cells of your own. Right, so there's this real need for the immune system at some point to just say, okay, this is a superorganism. The self is a little bit of a mixture between the cells that I started out with, the cells that I've become through aging and the food I eat and the bacteria that are on my body. But this brings up the question of how do you know? How do you know foreign from self? How do you know that something on you is a bad bacteria versus a good bacteria? Okay, so there's two cell types that do that for you. The first ones, you'll recognize some of the parts of these from things you've heard and then probably in the clinic or what have you. First ones are called B cells. And B cells have the feature that on their surface, each one has a unique little sort of catcher's mitt that can catch things from the world at large. And you have on the order of something like 10 to the 9th different B cells in your body. And they each have a little different catcher's mitt for catching different things in the environment. So they literally can kind of detect a universe of different things that are in the wild. And they can see, for example, like a bacteria. And when they see a bacteria, they mature to become what's called a plasma cell that is basically a form of them that makes tons and tons of secreted form of this very same receptor that was on their surface in the first place, that special catcher's mitt. And it then goes into your blood, and these are called antibodies. And so if you ever get vaccinated, the idea of most vaccinations is you bring in like a little bit of viral particles in the shot you get. And your body then learns, okay, that's something bad, and these plasma cell reactions I'm showing you take place, and your body makes a ton of antibodies against those things, and then the next time a viral particle comes in, it gets sopped up. It gets literally coated with all the antibodies that are in your blood. And many of you maybe also would have had something when you go to a foreign country called passive vaccination where you get like horse serum. Literally, horses were given the thing that you're trying to be vaccinated against, and you can be given these antibodies as an injection, since usually you used to get it as like 5 milliliters of horse serum in your butt. And it was really painful, but, it protected you while you were in Asia, and you didn't have to have this reaction go on, and you could be immediately protected. So this is a form of recognition, right? So each of these is very unique. One of these might recognize a form of flu, but another B cell in your body may recognize a different form of flu. And so when you go to get a flu shot, you're educating some of these to become flu reactive, to make a whole bunch of antibodies so that your blood is just full of these collections of antibodies that are against different things, and that provides you protection, right? There's another set of cells that are equally important, perhaps even more important, particularly in the context of things like viruses. And so these are called B cells, and it has a very weird origin. And they're found originally in the bursa fibrosis, which is a little part of the bone of birds. And so they were first found there, and so they were called B cells, like bursa fibrosis is kind of a little region. T cells, by contrast, are named because they come through a little organ that's just above your heart called the thymus. And the thymus is most famous if you're culinary. It's one of the sweetbreads if you eat French food. So the thymus and the pancreas are these very rich organs that you can, or if you go to South America and in Argentina, they'll put them on a parrilla. They're delicious. Anyway, they serve a very important function because both of those are places where these immune cells are developing. Right? So the bursa is where you make B cells, and that's actually your bone marrow in humans is where we make our B cells. So you can think of a bone marrow if you want. And T cells come through the thymus. And so what T cells do that are different is that T cells also have a receptor on their surface. And here we're just showing the surface of a T cell. It would also be, I showed you one, right? But imagine it as a sphere for the moment. It has a T cell receptor on its surface. And what it recognizes is a little protein that is on every one of the rest of your cells that is a little carrier protein. It's called major histocompatibility complex, or MHC, and it carries a peptide, it carries a little bit of anything in the world. And this can be a peptide is a piece of a protein, right? And so you can have pieces of proteins from viruses, you can have pieces of proteins that are yourself, you can have pieces of proteins that come from bacteria, and all of them get put into a little groove. This molecule has a little groove in it, and basically this molecule displays peptides to this T cell and says, hey, here's something I saw. You know, this cell type can eat material, and then it might put it on the surface in one of these things, and then the T cell sees that, and it's kind of a dual recognition. The T cell has to both see this molecule, and it also has to see this peptide. And the reactions that sort of become important is that these things have relationship to each other. So we'll learn more about phagocytes. So if a phagocyte eats a bacteria, it can put pieces of that bacteria and peptides on its surface to present to T cells. It can also, the T cell then can interact with the B cell that has also seen the same bacteria, and so they can have a little, sort of conjugate reaction like one of the ones I showed you in the early movies. And the net result of this is maybe the B cells make a ton of themselves, and they make antibodies, and the T cells make copies of themselves, ready to see them wherever that peptide may show up again. And so the immune system is really like this memory. It has this memory of all the things that have happened, and there's two kinds of cells that really see that in the form of the molecular structure of everything else around you. These little peptides in one case, or the whole thing in the case of B cells, right? So you've got these kind of specialized cells that see things very specifically. So to give this a little bit of flavor, like so you can see this anatomically, I have to describe something that's called lymph nodes. And many of you will know these most intimately through your mother feeling your glands. The glands right here. Many people remember this, right? So if you have a cold, what your mother or you are feeling or your doctor is actually your lymph nodes. So you have a series of lymph nodes all over your body that are kind of like, if you want to think of this as an army analogy, your immune system arrays itself in lymph nodes kind of like a base. And that's the place where the immune system kind of has its home. And there's different zones within. These are basically sacks of cells, of immune cells. And there's zones that have B cells in them. Sort of to give you a dimensionality, this is not very well to scale. This can hold around 10 million total cells. Each of your little lymph nodes, maybe more, depending on which one it is. And when you get a cold or a flu, the reason why your glands swell is because you're getting a major immune response. And that's how your mother or you know that you're having a response to, like a flu or a local cold, is that those lymph nodes expand as the immune system expands, learning about the pathogen or the foreign thing and then starting to make copies of itself in order to handle it. And I'll show you a little bit of movies in real time of how that works. But again, keep in mind that this is zonal. There's different regions of this that we can look at. And the way we do this in the lab, to give you a flavor, we either can use biopsies coming from the clinic, or more often we do this in mouse models because of the accessibility of studying things there and really reliably, et cetera. So we can put, for example, labeled T cells from one mouse into another mouse. And we might do some sort of vaccination, for example, and then we can either put that, to literally invert that mouse underneath a microscope, or we could take an organ from it in order to study the cells within the organ and understand how they're all communicating with each other. So I'm going to show you a little bit about how that works. The red cells here are B cells, green cells are T cells. We're looking at this same organ. These are a couple that are slices through, and then you can render that on FOSS, but of course it's a three-dimensional, so I'm trying to give you a sense of the three dimensions. And it looks like this may not. Oh, yeah, this place is good. So this is sped up. But I hope you're recognizing something new immediately, is that these green T cells are crawling around a lot faster than the red cells. And the reason we think that is remember, the green cells have to survey surfaces to find those peptide MHC complexes, to find the bits of the world at large. So it requires that your immune system is basically crawling around your body all the time looking for stuff. And most of these T cells will live a fruitless, sad life where they never find what they want, what they're made for. But that's good for us if they never find what they're made for, because that means we're not infected. Whereas the B cells, because they're waiting for things to come touch them, seem to be able to just hang around in their little zone and wait for a bacteria to kind of come challenge them and hit them. So we have these, you have some things that represent the desire of the immune system to kind of catalog you and recognize you, that you can see in real time here. Okay, so I'm bringing up something about the immune system that's important, is that it has this feature of being motile. It's got to really survey your whole body. If a given T cell is against, or a B cell is against something that is possibly coming in through a cut in your arm, and it lives, and that T cell always lived in your leg, it wouldn't be able to see it. So what your immune system needs to do is constantly recirculate. And it does that in two ways. One is it uses the blood supply, you know, so you've got blood vessels coming through you. The reason we can even look at white blood cells, at immune cells, is because they're using your blood supply as a highway. So when you have blood drawn, there's red blood cells and there's white blood cells. The red blood cells are the ones that go through your blood carrying oxygen, and we know about all that. The white blood cells are your immune cells, and they're basically hitching a ride in the blood to visit other parts of your body. Okay, so when you have a reaction too, you'll also find that there are more and more white blood cells in your, just like your lymphs or your glands are bigger, there's more and more immune cells in your blood because they've been mobilized in order to figure out what's going on, and many of them are expanding. But that's one highway. There's also a set of highways that you may not know as well that are called lymphatics. And lymphatics are important because they serve two functions. One is to take the cells back out of the tissue, but their major function in a lot of ways is to have fluid recycle. So all the time that you guys and we're sitting here right now, our tissues are leaking. The blood is a little bit of water leaking out of our blood vessels and into our tissues. And if we didn't have lymphatics, we would swell up. So, for example, diabetics have this issue, is that their legs swell up because their lymphatics aren't working very well. But the lymphatics basically acts as another set of vessels that drain you. And in the course of draining you, they don't just drain the fluid back out, but they drain the fluid through the lymph nodes. Right, so if your arm, you know, a little bit of fluid comes out into you, to my hand right now, the blood vessels leak a little bit, that fluid is slowly percolating back up through these lymphatic vessels. And as they reach my armpits or my, you know, nodes here, they reach little bubbles. These are lymph nodes, are basically little balls, bubbles. And the immune cells sit there and they wait for stuff that's coming from the tissue to return. And if I've gotten a cut, like maybe I just cut myself here, the bacteria and a lot of the things are just going to slowly percolate and go to that lymph node. And so it represents a very nice way to survey your body. You've always got to recirculate this fluid anyway. Lymphatics exist as this little node where all that stuff can pass through. So all the cells have to do is go lymph node to lymph node to lymph node, and they can basically end up seeing any sort of major thing that might happen to you, right? Because that's going to drain into them. And you have a lot of different lymph nodes they have to visit. I'm just showing you some of the ones. Tonsils, for example, that you have removed are also lymph nodes by another name. The ones in your neck are called lymph nodes. There's ones in your armpits. Some people that might have had, when you were a kid, kissing disease, mononucleosis, thank you very much. Mononucleosis, you will remember having very, very big, you know, like balls right here or in your armpits. Those are the lymph nodes, again, that have expanded like crazy. So there's ones right at the joint, right by your legs, that are prominent. There's also ones in your gut that are draining your intestines. So just to give a sense of these, I just took a couple pictures from a online source, for example. So there's the axillary lymph nodes that drain all along your armpits. And there's also ones all along the mesentery. So this is the small intestine, and all along that, there is mesentery, is the connective tissue that kind of holds the loops of your guts together. And your mesentery drains fluid out through the lymph nodes again. And then ultimately, all your lymph nodes converge on the portal vein and re-release fluid back into your bloodstream so you can reuse it. So this is just an example of that. There's a few of these that are called Peyer's patches that are literally little bumps here expanded out that are along the small intestine. So again, there's a lot of places in your body where there are little kind of bases where your material through your body is draining. Okay. So I took some time to introduce B cells that make antibodies, and T cells that sort of seize things on the surfaces of other cells. There's a few other kind of cells we call adaptive. Adaptive means each one has a role in recognizing something that's foreign. You also have an immune system that's more ancient, that's part of the whole system. It's called the innate immune system. And the ones that I mentioned already are the macrophages. These are cells that are just out there, and they're gobbling up things. Particularly if you see bacteria, they'll gobble it up. Dendritic cells are another form of that. They just are called that because they're macrophages with these very, very pronounced dendrites, little arms. A couple other ones you might know, mast cells are the ones that are responsible if you eat shellfish and you get a response. Mast cells basically are lining all over your tissue, and they're full of really bad stuff that's meant to kill worms. And many of us in this country don't experience worm infections, but most of the rest of the world does. So mast cells are there, and their role is to degranulate and spit bad stuff when they see it. And so it just so happens that you can get, you know, responses to things like shellfish, and then all the mast cells across your body will just all of a sudden say there's some bad stuff going on, and they'll degranulate, and that causes hives. A few other cell types that you may recognize the names of. So this is kind of a more ancient immune system, and this is the one that we think of as sort of having an ability to see patterns. And I'm going to introduce that really quickly. So this is a primer on what we call innate immunity. So neutrophils, macrophages, dendritic cells, these are some names for this. They can all recognize patterns that initiate their response. So remember how I said that B cells and T cells are seeing things like proteins and peptides, they're seeing things in the world using their special receptors. Well, these kind of cells, these innate ones, use receptors on their surfaces that see things that are common to certain microorganisms. So, for example, RNA viruses are defined because they're coming into your body carrying RNA. You don't normally have them, RNA really in your cytosol in the same way that you would when a virus comes in. And so you have sensors in your body that are sort of like, oh, there might be a virus present. It doesn't know which virus. It doesn't know the sequence of the virus, but it just recognizes that there's RNA where it's not supposed to be, you know, and how your cells are compartmentalized, the DNAs in the nucleus, the RNAs in certain places. There's also receptors on many of your cell surfaces that are for what we call pattern-associated molecular receptors. And these recognize, for example, the very common cell walls of bacteria. And again, your innate cell doesn't know what kind of bacteria it is. It just knows it's a bacteria because our cell walls don't have that component. So I wanted to introduce something we call these innate cells. And so these are just going to be out there gobbling up things that they see that have a pattern. So you've got something that's very, very simple and very complex. And so I refer to this idea that your immune system is really an information system that's collecting information all the time about every cell in your body. And it can be looking for different things, including, for example, there's cells like neutrophils that just generally sense the pattern of damage. If your cells spurt out their contents like a sea cucumber or something like that, you know, the material that spit out, neutrophils are like, oh, there's some damage here. They sense that as a pattern. I mentioned these pattern receptors for like bacterial cell wall components. Neutrophils and macrophages can see those and they'll eat them. And then I mentioned the idea is that T cells see these little peptides. So that's kind of information that may be produced, you know, by a macrophage that ate something because it saw a pattern. And so then it's going to produce a peptide that a T cell can see on its cell surface. So, you know, you also have things like things that B cells can see. So insult to your body can be in all kinds of different forms, and you've got cells to sense all that. So I want to show you a little bit about how the innate system is a sentinel for your system. And so this is basically a thin portion of your skin that is mostly skin. It's mostly the protective barrier that we associate with skin. But the immune system is there, and I just rotating this around. Each of these is a kind of a macrophage or a dendritic cell that you can see as this rotates that they're kind of in a meshwork. They're spread around. So most of the black space is the stuff that your skin is supposed to do, that is provide you a barrier against the wall and the world outside. But your immune system is sitting there, you know, like covering every square inch with little feelers that are looking for patterns of what's going on with you in the world outside. Right, so the basic idea, like if you get cut, and this is, I'm coming, you know, don't worry, I'll get to the aspect of this that fits into cancer. But when you get cut, the basic idea is that these cells that I just showed you, these innate immune cells, might see the bacteria that might come into the cut. They will capture that because they have these pattern receptors on their surface. And they can carry that on the lymph and end up into a lymph node, where they can be presenting peptides. Meanwhile, they'll be sort of digesting that, and they can present peptides of that, little bits of it, to the local T cells and get them all jazzed up. So that the T cells then divide and go into the blood, and then they can come back and protect this tissue both now and in the future. Right? So that's kind of a primer on the idea about how your immune system probably is meant to work in the context of the protection that you know about. So I'm just going to show you a little bit about that reaction, because it's something that we visualize, and I think it's very nice to see it viscerally. So this is a lymph node. Green cells here are the innate cells. Many of them have trafficked from local tissue. And both the red and the blue cells are different kinds of T cells. And as we play this now, you can see all these dendritic arms. These cells want to be seen. They're showing off their arms to the rest of the immune system. And the red and the blue cells here, the red ones are ones that we labeled with red because they're recognizing their antigens. So they stopped informed interaction. So they're not moving anymore. And the blue ones are cells that can't see that pathogen or the foreign thing that we put into the mice. And so they continue to survey. So your immune system has like all these components and they're all like individual agents. Again, the red cells have like figured out that the green cells are showing them stuff. And so they've stopped to have a chat. And the blue cells are still looking for what they want. And you know, if we're lucky, most of your B cells or your blue, most of your cells are always blue cells, just looking and not seeing any danger. Okay. So we come back to this idea that everything has to be sort of interaction. I'm going to go past this because I want to emphasize one more thing as we get into the concept of disease, which is, you know, this again, the idea that the immune system is embedded in your tissues. And we can reveal this by taking something like a whole lung and we can image it. And so you can kind of get a sense that we did this like your iPhone does. We took a panorama of a whole bunch of square tiles where we imaged through the lung at this one spot, and then we moved over a field and took the next one over. And so you know, we can take that data in a computer and rotate that around for you. And so this is the large branching airway. This is how you breathe. The blood or the air kind of branches down into smaller and smaller units. And here we've only labeled the bigger airways. I'm going to peel this all away for you so you can get down to a single layer of this tissue. And then you can see some of the other views that you're used to. So again, this is an airway, a small branched airway. And then these little dots are individual nuclei. That was a blood vessel just there that we passed. And all these little holes here are the alveoli, the air sacs, just in a single cross-section. So this is a cross-section of a few that are close together. This is the top of one, for example. And if we put dyes onto that, so for example, here we put dyes that label the lung epithelium or the immune cells, you can again see this idea that there's all kinds of different immune reactions going on. This is, mouse that's breathing so that we could watch it. And you see the green cells that shoot through on the blood. Those are going to transiently survey your lung. And then you see these little green guys that are stably in there. Those are called alveolar macrophages, and they just sit there and they hope to, you know, we're breathing in particles all the time, and they breathe in, they absorb those, and mostly they just digest whatever they see. So I think this gives you a sense of, you know, the idea that right now you're being protected by a system that really just innately is cleaning up your body. And I think that's the next theme that I want to get into, is the idea that the immune system is not just there to protect you against things, but at some point it's keeping the peace. It's making sure that everything is more or less as it's meant to be. Right. So the big reveal is that now that comes back to cancer and disease is that from the very beginning, innate and adaptive immune cells can live permanently within tissues. So I showed you this movie before, but what you should now remember is that, you know, I've told you about this lovely concept of immune cells that go from your periphery to your lymph node, and they make reactions there when you get a foreign pathogen. But your entire body, as I just showed you in the lung, is just always populated with the immune system as well. And that immune system is there keeping the peace for the tissues as a whole. And I'll get into a little bit about that. So I'm going to tell you the story a little bit about how we came to some of the recent advances in immunotherapy of cancer. Now with the backdrop of this, and then we'll expand out into other diseases and back and forth to cancer for the rest of the time. So you know, I told you about these T cells, and for a moment, let's just call them the executioners. They're the ones that actually do a lot of the work in the immune system. They produce cytokines and things that destroy foreign organisms. And then there are these cells that we talked about, like the phagocytes, that we're going to think about as instructive because they can provide peptides that they've, you know, bacteria that they've eaten or foreign organisms. So in about the mid-90s, I was studying, you know, this kind of reaction, and we knew of a receptor on the surface of T cells that, you know, not too curiously, it was called the T cell receptor. It's the receptor that sees these peptide complexes. And we knew at the time that those turn T cells on. Right, so that was an important feature. Say, okay, that's how T cells get activated. They see their peptide, and that turns them on. There's intracellular signaling that goes on, and there's kind of a longer story there. But at the time, there were all kinds of other molecules we didn't know what they did. And it turned out that I started to study one that was called CTLA-4. That over the course of a graduate career, I realized that its function was to turn T cells off. So the immune system always had a set of brakes that was able to turn it off. And once we kind of realized that. I had made an antibody. It turns out this is, antibodies can block things just as much as the immune system uses them to detect stuff. We can use them to grab whatever we want. And so I was able to get an antibody that would grab this receptor and prevent it from seeing the molecule that would normally turn the cell off. So if you think about this, this is a double negative, right? We can block a negative signal. So blocking a negative signal means basically make this positive signal the only game in town, right? So now, and this is called checkpoint blockade, this being the checkpoint, this is the thing that the cells are using to check their activity. Now the cell was more active, right? And I'll tell you a little bit more detail about this in a moment, but the net result is, you know, 2016, this is a friend of mine, actually. This was his scans, essentially. And this was a tumor mass that was adjacent to his lungs. And this was after 6 weeks on these drugs that was completely melted. The immune system had infiltrated that and had destroyed that entire melanoma metastasis simply because this reaction was all going full bore. And really, I'm going to break that story down for you a little bit in terms of the science. So again, T-cell surface. I'm going to tell you the story sort of from another perspective. T-cell surface, T-cell receptor, those peptide MHC complexes. These are some of the molecules we knew in sort of the mid-90s. New molecule CTLA-4 comes along. We do this reaction where we say, okay, if I treat a T-cell with a trigger that triggers the T-cell receptor, and it's called CD3 here, so we give it a constant amount of that. We could give it a signal called CD28 that would make it go better. And so this is titering in CD28, and the bars represent how well the T cells go, so they get better and better. And in this axis, we put in the inhibitory signal, the one we now know to be inhibitory, and we could turn the cells back off. And so think about this. This is the equivalent of knowing that your immune system is like a European shower, that you can turn a single dial and go from, you know, cold to hot. And if any of you have been in any crappy European hotels, of course, you know there's like a fine line between frigidly cold and really hot that's like that. But the immune system has a little bit more control than that. They have a little better thermal control. And basically this means that you can dial them up and you can dial them down in the lab. And what was really nice about this story is that within about a month of doing this experiment, I did this experiment, which was basically to look at T cells expanding. This axis here is the number of T cells in a mouse versus days post-injection of a vaccination. And you can see after you vaccinate here at 0 hours, by about 48 hours, the cells had expanded. That's the immune system getting all jazzed up to the vaccination. And then over time, your immune system rests down, and it's about 2 or 3 times as dense as it was before. You have memory within there, though. But this was when we blocked CTLA-4. We could get the immune system to go at least twice as high and remain high longer. And that was just to a vaccination. So that really motivated us to go at a mouse model where tumors grow and kill the mice over the course of about 20 days here. But when we blocked CTLA-4, in other words, made the T cells go higher, basically the immune system rejected the tumors. So the tumors melted. They were already growing at this point when we inject. You can see we're injecting right here. Tumors are already growing, and basically those tumors go into a sort of a long state of remission. And, that took about 17 years to go from this result, because no one really believed this at the time, to the clinical results. And this is what I showed you earlier. This is the clinical asset that represents this. And again, this may not look like a lot, except that most people that have this disease are dead by here. And so here's 20% or so, 10 to 20%, depending on this study, survive with this drug, the one I'm showing you here. And this is a second generation version of that. This is two drugs together that do the same thing. And again, you're getting about 50% of people that go on to, well, they'll die of other things, which is called a cure. So we cured cancer. So these are really exciting. This is a real excitement because it represents a whole new idea about how to treat cancer, right? Here the idea is you don't try to attack the cancer at all. You make a drug that, rather than trying to find the tumor, doesn't care about what the tumor is. It recognizes the immune system can help catalog that. It's got all kinds of ways of seeing the different material. And all you got to do is you got to boost it up. And so you get these results, and I'm just giving you that these are approved now. So these are two different drugs that together can give you, you know, pretty good responses. And I'll show you a little bit more about different diseases in a moment. And then there's people that don't respond to those even now. And so that's what we're going to spend most of the rest of the talk talking about, is like, why did this happen? Why did the immune system do this? And why does it do it in some people and not in others? And what can we do about that? And how does that relate to disease even beyond cancer? Okay, so we call these people non-responders. And if you take a disease like melanoma and you give this, here I'm just showing you the data just for one of the two drugs. So that's why these response rates are lower. But for like melanoma, for one drug, not the two combined, is about 25-30% of the people respond. Great, because without this, you know, like very few people were living at all. Non-small cell lung cancers, roughly 20% of people responding. Some gastric cancers, some urothelial, some, head and neck, and this is non-small cell lung cancers of two different variants. You see different response rates. So you see these, you know, a lot of cancers are starting to show responses to this. But I give you now the example of colorectal cancer. Colorectal cancer, the majority of patients are this kind that are called MSI low. So really only 5% are these people. And nobody responds. So here's a case of cancer not being the same, right? This melanoma, some people respond. So we have this class of people, they're the non-responders. We have this class, which turns out to be two types of people that are responders. And then you have a disease like this where nobody responds. And so the question is, what is this really telling us about cancer? But also, what is it telling us about the role of the immune system in your body? And to explain this, this is why I titled this About Other Diseases, even though we're going to focus a lot on cancer. So I'm going to tell you about the immune system as we're now understanding it, and I'm going to put it all into one slide. So I've just shown you how the immune system has a big role in cancer. And 5-10 years ago, people would have said, you have to attack the cancer. The immune system's maybe not going to be useful. But there's a few other systems that have revealed themselves to be really intimately involved in the immune system, and I think are going to make you think about the immune system differently. So the first one I want to talk about is your brain. So if you did not have an immune system, and I don't know if you're going to remember this talk in general, but if you did not, you definitely would not remember this. And the reason is that in your brain, each of your neurons forms somewhat on the order of 1,000 different connections to other neurons, and that forms the circuitry of memory. If you want to form a really good memory, it turns out that two things have to happen. One is that one of those synapses gets stronger as a result of the experience you have, but other of the synapses actually have to slowly degrade. So you reinforce some circuitry. Imagine you make all the circuitry when you're just born, and some of it's just not even really used, but then you start to reinforce certain connections, and other ones have to degrade. Those are two obligate forms of how you form memory. The degradation is done by the immune system. So the reinforcement, you know, the neurons find each other and they touch each other and they make better connections as you form memory. But the pruning is done by macrophages. So the immune systems I was telling you about that see bacteria, they also have pattern recognitions on their surface that see your own cells and help prune you. Right? So your brain all the time is being pruned. You know, little things are going on as your immune system is going along and clipping wires that don't need to be connected anymore. And that's how you form memory. So that we didn't know that 10 years ago. You know, if I told you that 10 years ago, people would be like, no, that can't be true. Your immune system's not involved. But it's really clear now that the immune system is doing that. And the other side of that is that Alzheimer's is a disease now that's very much understood. The same cells that do the clipping cease to do the clipping. So as you get older, for reasons we don't understand, these cells are called microglia cells, and they're macrophages of the brain. They cease to do that effectively. They start to accumulate in large numbers, but they don't really clear the material in your brain. And that's really seems to be the number one indicator of some of the forms of dementia, including Alzheimer's. Again, so this is a case where your immune system is not what you thought it was. It's not just a system that defends you. It's a system that prunes you. And it can prune foreign things extensively, like killing them. But you, it does it more gently. Another example of that, by the way, I was mentioning the mammary, you know, the fact that in mammary, your mammary ducts branch. Well, when women go to lactate, that branching becomes more extensive. That's the development of lactation. And that branching is achieved by the immune system helping the branches form. And it prunes them and makes the branches what they are. So again, it's a function of your immune system that's not about defense. It's about making your organs work well. Okay, so neurodegeneration in the brain is one that just points to this idea that you didn't really understand what the immune system was about before. You thought it was all about defense. But one way to think about this is if you go back, like think back, I think it's about 1 billion years. You probably won't remember. I don't either. But the cells were in a big, you know, you had individual protists that were in a stew, we think. And then all of a sudden we started to have multicellular organisms like our own. Well, what had to happen at that point? Well, on the one hand, you had to make sure that something wasn't eating you. So that's the immune system that we kind of understood. You got to make sure you defend yourself, but you also got to make sure that you can get along. And so you, the junctions you want to be to have to make a tissue work, it seems like the immune system may have evolved at that point, not only to defend you, but also to take parts that weren't quite synonymous and make them work together. Another really classic one that I want to point out just in the passing is arteriosclerosis. So in a, particularly our parents' time, the idea of plaques depositing in your blood vessels was all about diet. And so you were told not to eat certain lipids, and that's still true. Diet does have a big effect on it. But if you look very carefully at, or you don't have to look that carefully at arteriosclerotic plaques, underneath them are angry macrophages. So the plaque deposition is in part because the immune system that's normally meant to help you with metabolism, how to deal with lipids in your body, have actually gotten upset. And we're not exactly sure why they do that and why they do that more with age, but it's clear that arteriosclerotic plaques are immune foci. Underneath that, all that lipid deposition that gums up your vessels is an immune reaction. And it's an immune reaction because presumably the immune system normally, well, we know the immune system normally is involved in helping you to digest some of the non-digestibles in your body, and including lipid metabolism. So again, it's a case where you kind of didn't really necessarily understand, you know, what your immune system was all about until we start to see it showing up everywhere. Cancers, I've mentioned, obviously things like autoimmunities, but the one that's really, I think, very popular and very obvious, and I mentioned it already a little bit, is the idea that in your gut you have 10 times more bacteria than you have in the whole rest of cells in the rest of your body, and you need to figure out which of those are commensals and which one might be pathogens. So commensals mean you need to actually make an immune response and recognize that that bug is a good one, figure out how to accommodate it. And then if another one comes in that's trying to break through the barrier and eat your gut from the inside, you got to defend, right? So that distinction represents, you got to know that one, you got to call one of those kind of self. You got to make recognize its peptides, and you got to make B cells against it. But instead of destroying it, you just want to quarantine it. You want to keep it, as long as it's in the gut, it's good. If it starts to come into you and get into your bloodstream, it's bad. So you need to quarantine. You need to also kind of categorize the world at large. And it's not just about blowing everything away, right? Okay, so how do we study these? I'm going to tell you a little bit about how things go on in the lab to understand these. There's a little movie that my lab made about the process. So the most important way to understand this is to start to catalog how the immune system is working in all those other settings. Say, okay, evolutionarily, we had this goal of getting along, of making our tissues work together. So how are the immune systems arraying themselves in that setting so that the cells all do what we want them to do? So this is Gabby, who's a technician in the lab. And she's just come from the OR, and she's gotten a piece of a biopsy material. So that's a piece of a tumor. And we typically do things like weighing it. And then we'll mince it up, because what we're ultimately trying to do is to release all the cells so we can understand what they are and what they're composed of. And she walks through the lab here, and she basically puts on it what's a glorified bread maker. It has the same chip in it, actually, that runs your bread maker. And it stirs that cocktail up for a while with some enzymes. At the end of it all, most of it has been degraded, so she spins down the cells in a centrifuge so that they become a pellet. She resuspends them, and she puts them on a very elemental counter that counts the cells. And then she's going to add a series of antibodies to them. Here, antibodies are being used as little markers, because remember, they're very specific, and she can split the sample into a whole bunch of different mini samples and put different markers on them, and then run them through an instrument that's called a flow cytometer. And she can essentially count all the different cell types and all the different features of all the different cell types that were from that original tissue. And each dot showing up on the graph there on that little screen was actually a cell. And it represents the idea that what we're trying to do at some point is we're trying to figure out where your immune system is the same. Like, for example, in autoimmunities, is it using the same tricks in autoimmunity that it actually should be using in a bacterial infection to get rid of the bacteria, or a viral infection to get rid of the virus? At what point does the immune system have a limited number of tricks that are meant for getting along, for getting rid of things, and at what point can we harness those to do the thing we want them to do when they're not behaving properly, like, for example, in disease? The way we're doing this at UCSF involves the idea of, like I just showed you, biopsies come in. And this can be blood or it can be tissue. And we essentially have this, we call this, what you just saw with Gabby, we call the disease to biology group. The idea is that this is at one point is a disease, but it's also biology. And we need to convert one to the other. The disease is what's coming in the clinic. Biology is what's taking place in the tissue that we can start to think of as how do we intervene in that. So there's a lab that basically helps to do that, There's a flow cytometry lab. That's where you saw the tube going up in the very end. That's an instrument that allows us to count cell by cell using basically an inkjet printer that goes by a laser, and we can watch each cell come through the flow cytometer. We can also image that whole tissue. I've been showing you a lot of images. We can do genomics on that, so we can study the gene expression. And the basic idea is to get this huge multidimensional array understanding of what the immune system is in that piece of tissue. And what this amounts to, you know, I think many of you heard the term big data used, for example, like if you go on Google, if I were to click on Google right now, most of my keystrokes are being logged. So sorry to ruin your evening, but most of your keystrokes are logged, and sometimes anonymously and sometimes not so much. But the idea there is that by noting the things you do, they can classify you and they can advertise to you, right? So it's a very straightforward thing. Maybe they can give you better information the next time, and that's a very noble cause. But the basic idea is that they classify you. So you'll notice that if you go enough and you look at really dude stuff like, you know, razors and whatever, you'll get advertised lawnmowers and jeans. And if you do perfume and whatever, you're probably going to get advertised things that are from, you know, so that's a simple idea of classifying you by gender stereotypes. But that's ultimately the same idea of big data that we're trying to do here. We're trying to figure out how the immune system might be similar in some cancer patients and different in other cancer patients, and why the drugs work in some versus works in the other. So I'm going to show you a little bit of how that data unfolds through this process here. So again, we're taking many, many, many specimens from different kinds of diseases, and we're taking them through this pathway, and then we're studying them. And at the end of the day, we create a pretty big database so we can understand one disease, but we can also think about how the immune system is taking patterns from other diseases or from other kind of left field settings as a way to start to template the cures of the future. So one way we do this is through imaging, and I've sort of already described this in terms of the idea of making movies to look at things. I showed you the one before. This is, you know, at the lab level, this represents something that takes on a quote that my father sent to me at one point when I was telling him what we were doing. So my father's a musician and a music historian, and he sent me this quote from Gustav Mahler about it. He wrote about a symphony that he was writing. And he's writing this is a note to his brother. And he says, I want the symphony to represent something like the dancing figures in a brilliant lit ballroom that you look to from outside, and you're far enough away, and the doors are closed maybe, and you can't hear the music. And at that point, all the movements would seem senseless. Well, that's essentially what happens when you image, is you see stuff, and you have to infer what's going on. But at the same time, you can sort of make very, very good calculations. And so I'm going to show you a movie in the last 10 minutes or so that represents a huge insight for us in terms of all kinds of things about what I've just told you about. Okay, so this is a movie that we collected about 5 years ago. And I showed you this in still at the very beginning. This is the black area here is a tumor. And the yellow and green and orange are all forms of inhibitory innate cells. So cells that remember the innate cells are the ones that sort of recognize patterns. These guys surround the tumor and they recognize patterns. And I call them inhibitory because they turn T cells off. They present peptides to them, and the resulting of that is that they turn T cells off. But there's one little gem right here of two little stimulatory dendritic cells. This is not a very frequent little field of view, but I've obviously trimmed this because it's going to be able to show you that the immune system has got some good stuff going on even when it's mostly bad. So there's a lot of reactions like the one that's going to play out here. The T cells are in blue, and they're interacting with a lot of these inhibitory myeloid populations here. So we watch these like Mahler would have wanted us to watch his, you know, Third Symphony. And you know, he goes, you know, now we're starting to understand actually the music behind this is that these cells are turning off these T cells. And that's dampening down the immune response so that you don't make a response to the tumor even though you've got T cells there. But this little reaction here is a gem. And the reason we know it's a gem is, I don't know if you notice the difference in the blue. The dye that we used to stain the T cells turned out by complete happenstance to change color just a tiny bit as T cells got activated. And so as we were watching this, we were like, well, there's weird. First of all, there's a little reaction going on there. And second of all, the T cell color is a little bit more blue, a little less green. And so we started to wonder what that was, and we realized that this is a stimulatory reaction. Here the immune system's being turned on against the tumor. Here the immune system's being turned off. Most of what you look across lots and lots of movies, most of what you'll see is what you saw here. this sort of inhibitory reaction. And very little is what you saw here, but it's a little bit like trying to get a squirrel to come out of a hole. We've identified a squirrel that's a really good thing, and this is, it's not very much of one, but it turns out to be the immune reaction you want. And instead of what we want, most of what's happening when people come in the clinic is this inhibitory reaction. Right. So we can measure this by this method I called flow cytometry. So we can count a lot of those cells. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, but the good red stimulatory cells and the green, yellow, bad inhibitory cells can be counted because we can use something that's sort of like an inkjet printer. It's called a flow cytometer. Instead of ink, we're putting the cells that Gabby digested into that. And as they go past a laser, we can read out all kinds of details of them. We can count them. And if we do that, and we look at this comes back to metastatic melanoma. We look at people that are non-responders versus responders, and we count the cells that are in their tumor microenvironment. We find out that the cells that I showed you, those red ones that are nucleated in that good reaction that we happen to notice with the blue dye changing color, those people that have lots of those cells, so this is the number of cells they have on this axis, they're the responders. We've grouped people into responders and non-responders. And people that don't have very many of those are the non-responders. So we're starting to say, hey, that two biology we saw in that movie, it's really important because having the good stuff, the ones that are turning T cells on, is associated with people being able to get their immune system going. The immune system's got something to build on. The little squirrel can be coaxed out of the hole. Whereas in the non-responders, you don't have very much to go on. You've only got that inhibitory system to work with. Turns out that you can basically build on that, and you can say, well, why do you have the good cells that are making the T cells good, those stimulatory cells? And it turned out that when we looked at all our data more and more carefully, a little bit like Google mining theirs, this axis here shows the number of the good cells, the ones that make the immune system go forward, those innate ones, the red cells that are making the blue cells turn bluer. And this is a cell called a natural killer cell, and there's a nice linear relationship. This is melanoma. This is in head and neck. Head and neck is ridiculous. The p-value is 0.98, and there's this 91. It's a very high correlation between one population and the other. And it turns out, and this is a kind of a complicated graph, but I'll try to explain it to you, that if you take a bunch of patients, this is like 20-some patients, and you categorize them as a non-responder, you say, okay, well, you know, 3 months later, who responded to my drug? And I'll call them a zero here versus a one who's a responder or green or yellow. I can ask what cell populations in their tumor associated with that. And the two cell types are one of that cell that I showed you in the top right of the movie. These are these dendritic cells, the red ones that I showed you making the good immune reaction. Here are the NK cells that I showed you that correlate with them. Red here means that patients have large numbers of those cells. So you can see the responders typically have large numbers of both NK cells and those good dendritic cells. And non-responders, you're in really bad shape if you don't have either of those populations. So cancer patients are not the same because their immune systems are not the same. We're treating them with immune drugs, and we need to understand the system that really is necessary for them, their immune system, to get going. And it's that one that I showed you in the movie. It's the interaction of those good dendritic cells, and it turns out there's some NK cells here too. This creates what we call an archetype. So as we study this, we're understanding the immune system gets a bunch of its cells together and makes a group that can do good things. So I've just told you about one here that's these NK cells that it turns out they work together to make these good dendritic cells. The good dendritic cells work together with CD8 T cells so that when they come back into the tumor, they all work together to destroy the tumor. And so this represents the idea that as we build up our understanding of the immune system, we start to see collections of cells that represent an axis. And that axis we're calling an archetype. Such that if you look at all melanoma patients, about 40% of the people that respond have this axis that has these good innate cells, and they have a good adaptive population, and they basically have other cells that go together with them. They generally actually survive even well without drugs compared to the rest of the population. But we have people that we understand that they have a different immune biology than the patients that don't respond. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go past this, but I'm going to point out that something that some of you with eagle eyes might have noticed is that there were some exceptions to this rule I told you, and it basically comes down to the idea that there's some patients here that respond for a different reason. They have a different set of immune cells that helps to protect them. So here's the patients that have the sort of the archetype I've just described, the good innate cells and the good NK cells and the good CD8 T cells. There's a population of here that have another kind of immune cell called CD4, lymphocytes. They have a different kind of dendritic cell that's down here. And so you have the world dividing itself into two patients, populations. I'm going to go again because of time past this, just to point out that you start to see patients in different balls, even though we're calling them all cancer, that their immune systems are different. These people were very lucky. They're treatable by our drugs. There's a portion of these other ones that are very lucky. They're also part of that green population I was just showing you. But then we're starting to see these other classes of patients that have different immune compositions, and that means that they're responsive. We don't have anything to build on. So that's important because we can start to place those into different indications. We can say, okay, so some diseases like melanoma have these two good classes, but maybe in head and neck we only have one good class and we have a bunch of bad ones. Right? So we start to understand cancer not as the disease of origin, but really as the disease of the immune system. Like, why is the immune system protecting and how is it protecting and what is its assets and what are its liabilities? So this comes back to this question, what to do for the non-responders. And I'm just going to show you one thing that we've been doing in a company that's an offshoot from UCSF that I hope you'll understand, is if in general, if we look in normal tumors, we find not really enough T cells, and we find too many of the inhibitory populations of innate cells that I told you about. Yellow cells here, and sorry, the bars are different colors than what we've been seeing before, but the yellow cells were the good dendritic cells, the ones that I've just been telling you about that are really associated with good prognosis. We've been able to find drugs that basically lower the burden of the inhibitory immune system, so lower the number of these red bad cells, maintain the number of the good yellow cells, and bring in more T cells. And those drugs take basically non-responders, in the case of tumors, and we're hoping in the case of patients now, where the tumors are growing out, and convert them into cures. And so the idea of this really is to really repurpose the immune system and take advantage of these things. And it brings me back, just as the last slide, I'm going to open up for questions here, to this idea that the immune system really is not really what you've been thinking it is. It has a really intimate ability to recognize cancer, because cancer is a disease in which the immune system is present, just as the immune system is present in all your tissues. And as we understand these other diseases, and in fact, if we understand health, we also probably have the templates to treat the cancers that we don't currently treat. Namely, we have understanding of what the immune system is capable of doing and is really what it's made to do. And I would say that we're just breaking that open right now, but it's a really exciting time because we've already shown with cancer that we can leverage it. We can figure out what its assets are, and we can put them to good use, and we can figure out who's going to respond. And now we're in the course of figuring out, of course, as I just showed you, how to treat the people that are not. So with that, I would be happy to take questions, or in fact, to kind of discuss any of the ideas that have come up over the last hour. So the question was, can you introduce additional T cells into the body in order to jumpstart it, or maybe to improve it? And there's a whole therapeutic series of trials that are going on, utilizing either a patient's own T cells that have been expanded in the lab. It's called autologous T cell transfer, autologous meaning from the same person. But there's another variant of that is much more an engineering approach that is called chimeric antigen receptor, or CAR T cells, that you may read about or hear about, that involves the idea that you take a patient, say I'm a patient, I'll take the cells out of me, and I put on their surface additional receptors that help that my T cells all become specific for the tumor, right? And then I try to put those back into me and get them to, obviously leverage the idea that the immune system then maybe can teach other cells, okay, this is a bad thing, and watch out, this, even as it mutates, let's watch this thing. And that's a therapeutic avenue that's being explored. It has a downside because it is hard to get the immune system to figure out exactly how the immune system communicates between populations. And ultimately, if you generate a CAR that's just against one thing that's wrong in the tumor, you're kind of doing what we did 20 years ago. You're trying to attack the tumor, right? You're saying, I'm just going to use the immune system as a drug, just like I tried to make a drug before. And most of what is happening with CARs is that the tumor is wily and escapes by changing that exact feature that you targeted with the immune system. But there is hope, obviously, that you bring in the cells and you bring them armed correctly, and they will teach the rest of the immune system to see that thing as foreign. Sure. Well, yeah, but what's interesting... Yeah, so the question was that I was saying that they were non-responders didn't have enough T cells. But I didn't exactly say that. In fact, what you find in non-responders is that they have T cells, but most of their T cells are in a state that's repressed. And here's where we can talk about something I didn't show here. One of the funny features of the immune system is what it does with viral infection. So most of you are used to the idea that when you get a cold, you ultimately clear it, that all the virus gets killed. And that's mostly true. The antibodies you make over time sop up viral particles, and in a good world, you're sterilized at the end of that, so you don't have any more viral particles. But take herpes infection. Many people in this room have herpes infections, CMV. Herpes, obviously, not the oral one is very common. And what that does, herpes, it infects your nerves. It is very hard to get rid of. It is extremely, it'll go quiet for years and years and years, and then people have a cold sore, right? They'll have a stress moment in the cold sore. Same with CMV is a very common virus that's passed when high schoolers are kissing. It's something called another one of these kissing viruses. It can come in saliva. Okay, so let's take the herpes as an example. It's sitting in your nerves. What should you do? Well, you might think, let's get rid of that, clear it out. Well, what's going to happen if you do that? You're going to kill the neuron. So what happens to you into evolutionary fitness? You don't have sensation. You don't have motor, right? So if you killed every virally infected cell in your body, you might kill yourself. Same with HPV, right? HPV is liver virus, hepatitis B. If you killed every infected cell that had hepatitis B, you get liver damage. You get liver disease, and you die. So evolutionarily, it's quite possible, and I think what we're learning is that the immune system, in order to get us past reproductive stage, makes kind of compromises and says, I'm not going to sterilize you. Instead, if the virus remains quiescent, like in your nerves, like herpes virus, or in your liver, like most of your life, if you have HPV or HCV, I will just have an immune system that kind of accumulates a bunch of T cells that can see that, but I'm going to keep them in a quiescent phase. I'm not going to let them get too reactive unless the virus comes out of dormancy. And then I've got a T cell response that's kind of, and so we call those exhausted T cells. And you see them more and more. Again, I'm talking about how we're seeing the immune system. We see more and more in your body that a lot of your cells have this phenotype that they aren't really, that we call them exhausted in the sense that you're exhausted when you go home and you lie on the couch and you just can't, kind of feel like you can't move. But if a fire alarm came on, you'd get up. Right, even if you were exhausted. So think about the immune system the same way. Say you had a response to a virus, but you didn't want to like kill the nerves. But if it comes out of and starts infecting all your other cells, then you do. It's like a fire alarm. That's what we think might be taking place in a lot of tumors. Is that same system that has this kind of exhausted quiescence has been accessed by the tumor? How, we don't know, but it's essentially taking the immune system, and there are lots of T cells in there. But they're in this exhausted state. And part of that exhaustion seems programmed by the innate cells that we've been talking about a little bit in that crosstalk. We don't fully understand how, but this is a very long answer to your question, but it's a very long question when you think about it. It's not that you don't have T cells in tumors. I showed you a lot of examples where there were T cells in tumors, and those tumors were growing. It's more that the T cells that are in there and the immune system has adopted a stance that isn't the one we want. The one we want would be to destroy the tumor. Instead, it's kind of accepting it and letting it grow. And that's the distinction we need to understand. That's why I point out these other diseases where you're saying the immune system's got all these other things it's doing, and maybe tumors are accessing those things. And to understand those things is to understand where they came from and to understand how to reverse them and then reverse them in cancer. So it's a very long question, but it's actually, you're hitting kind of the bigger issue right on. Yeah, and I think it comes back to the previous question a little bit when we think about a tumor has to learn two things now. As I told you at the beginning, we've always understood the idea that a tumor needs to get so that it doesn't have growth control anymore. So it loses the innate sort of control over its division, so it starts to divide and divide. But the second thing we now understand is it needs to fool the immune system into thinking that it's all part of a wound that's repairing, or a brain that's remodeling, or a breast that's remodeling, or any number of these patterns that I've been trying to describe to you. That can be arrived at by the right mutations. And if you give us all long enough time for all of our cells, one of them, by turning the combination locks and of all the different genes and mutating them, will arrive probably at the right solution that might might be predestined because of genes that were already turned into the right combination. You know, like what Jenny was probably talking about, genes that are already in the wrong state because of a mutation. But then if you add mutation upon mutation upon mutation, some cells will get lucky and they'll start to look like a remodeling brain. And then your immune system can be fooled into thinking, that's a remodeling brain. I just need to kind of help it. As opposed to what we'd like to have it do is say, that's a tumor. Or that looks like a virus that I really need to get rid of, which is the archetype that we want it to take. So I think you're definitely onto something with the idea that certain mutations can help a tissue look like a particular immune state that dials in immunity in the wrong form. It dials in this get-along form as opposed to the destroy-me form, which is what we want it to do. Well, this is a good question. You know, there's a lot of sort of snake oil in immunology right now. And I'll tell you two things that are probably not really good to do. One of them is this idea of boosting immunity globally. So there's a number of, sort of herbal supplements that say boost your immune system. And if you understood anything of what I just said right now, is there's this idea that, you know, boosting your immune system can cause autoimmunity. It's not that you want to boost it globally. In fact, the drugs that we make are kind of in that class, and we would like to get them to be more specific. So it's a really hard question to answer because I'm not sure that we know, like, what do you want? Do you want a better response to viruses? If so, though, that might actually give you more likelihood of getting an autoimmunity where your immune system sees everything as a virus, right? And then that can include, like, your pancreas, and so you get diabetes, or it can include various other tissues, like your nerves, so you get multiple sclerosis, which is an autoimmune disorder. So there's no right answer to your question, but I think there are wrong answers. And I gave the example of boost your immune system that, you know, just on the face of what I've told you, isn't specific enough. What do you want to boost and why? What is it that your body needs because of who you are and what your experience is and maybe what viruses you've carried or what, genes you're carrying in your body? Another example, though, that's quite important to point out right now, it's the data is coming out really strongly. This is there's a lot of companies that sell what they have named probiotics. So these are the idea that they're going to give you bacteria that are pro. They're for you. They're professional, whatever that pro is supposed to mean in that name. But there's no scientific merit for those names. And in fact, what's becoming very clear in the context of immunotherapies is that patients that take probiotics do much worse. And it's because one of the best things that your bacteria in your body can do is be diverse. That seems that some element of that's becoming clear, that you want to have, like in all biological systems, you want to have the ability to kind of do a lot of different things. And what you do with probiotics is the diversity of your gut bacteria goes really down. It goes towards those 3, 4, 5, 10 that are in the pill. And so the diversity of your gut bacteria is worse, and the associated outcomes are clear. On the other hand, people that eat a cup a day of fiber and they actually get a very diverse microflora do much better to those drugs. So there's a lot of – what I'm kind of pointing out is there's a lot of things that sort of on the – if you don't think about them enough, your intuition will tell them, oh, yeah, I should take probiotics. Probiotic. That's got to be – but it's a name, right? And think about what your immune system really is about, and you'll say that's not quite so obvious that that's what you want to do. You don't necessarily want to only have 3 good bacteria in your body. What about having a diversity of the bacteria that all have different things to help you be healthy, right? The reason you have commensals is because some of them help you digest certain things. Bile acids, the main way that you take care of lipids, are made by certain strains of bacteria. You know, in other words, the chemicals floating in your bloodstream, some of the most important ones are made by things that are not you. And so the idea of toying with that, you know, sort of just saying, oh, these ones are better than those, is pseudoscience, and it's not quite yet there. Someday it will be. I have no doubt that we'll get there, but it'll also probably be very personalized, where what you need and what I need may be kind of a little different based on how we were raised, what we normally eat, what our, you know, genes are. And at the moment, I can't really give you the answer to that because I don't think we know. So I think that's generally true. But if you look at vitamin C metabolism in this room, each of us has different enzyme levels based on our genetics that will degrade them at different rates. So the FDA requires, you know, gives you numbers from vitamin D is a more classic one, and retinoic acid too. But in general, vitamin metabolism varies a lot among the population. So this idea that there's an FDA level of 100% or you should have more of that or less is also very individual. If you have the biosynthetic enzymes that degrade those, then you might need a lot more than I do. So I think it's generally true. I think vitamin C is generally, you know, is generally something that is antioxidant, and it helps you deal with some of the things that can be bad for your cells. But the degree to which you need more of it, I'm not sure that we know exactly whether you having an orange a day is plenty for you. You know, and for me, I need to have a gallon of juice. So T cells I remember when I was telling you about all the confusing names that we give to lymphocytes, one of them was a cytotoxic T lymphocyte. So T cells actually have the ability, when they see a peptide being presented by an MHC, they have the ability to directly release toxins into the adjacent cell, blow it up. And we think the reason for that is, in fact, and this goes back to the question I was asking the gentleman in the front, is that in some viral infections, you want to blow that thing up. You want to just, you know, really catch the virus before it started to replicate and just blow it away. And so cytotoxic T cells do that. There are other cells in your body, neutrophils notably, are ones that capture antibodies. Remember the floating free things that you make. And if a bacteria is bound by an antibody to a neutrophil, the neutrophil does something similar. It degranulates. It spits all its bacteria, it's all its toxic chemicals onto that bacteria and blows it up. So in that sense, a neutrophil is also an executioner. But this actually comes to the question behind you from earlier again about boosting your immune system. Do you want that? Well, in some senses, in some cases, you absolutely do. If bacteria, sepsis is raging through your body, you want the neutrophils popping those bacteria every which way. Get that going too fast, and you start to get the leakage of blood that is sepsis, right? So that fine line in sepsis can kill you in hours. Right, because everything just goes crazy in terms of cytokines, and your immune system just goes. It's like a nuclear bomb goes off, and your immune system is dangerous, right? So this is a system that can kill you. It can kill anything, and so that's where I think this shower analogy, what we learned with CTLA-4, is kind of an important one to say. You want it in the fine range of warm. You don't actually want to be hot all the time. You don't want your immune system ragingly hot all the time because you'll start to pop everything around. And you don't want it cold all the time because you won't recognize things are foreign. So you need it in that warm range. But maybe different tissues you need a little bit warmer than others, and maybe in different situations, different days, different exposures. And again, that idea of boosting it globally to me is a vast simplification that's just wrong because of these executioner functions. So a vast majority play on what I showed you we did in Berkeley, this checkpoint. So most of the drugs that are being developed in cancer immunotherapy are the idea of a molecule on the T-cell surface that generally turns the T-cell off and blocking that, or sometimes in a similar way engaging one that gives a positive signal. So that's a general class that are called checkpoint blockades. There are, however, a few pharma companies, quite a few programs, that play on some of the more subtleties of immune molecules. And I didn't describe these in any detail, but there's a set of immune molecules called cytokines. We've been talking a lot about how cells talk to each other by contact. Well, they can also broadcast their status via molecules that they secrete. And so, for example, if you get an immune response locally, you know, I didn't go into this great detail, but you can get kind of like a wave of these cytokine molecules that are released out and get all the cells locally a little bit jazzed up, right? Maybe a little bit active or a little bit likely to die or whatever, what have you. So in many, for example, autoimmunities or rheumatoid arthritis is a case where you have an immune reset reaction in your joints that is fulminant, is raging always a little bit. So there are drug companies that are making drugs that try to block those cytokines, that are blocking that general broadcast of damage, with the idea of trying to quell, you know, again, and cool things down a little bit locally via these very general signals that are made by inflamed immune systems. So, I mean, there's quite a lot of action in the immune system. Obviously, you can tell the cancer has really spurred a lot of people to think about how we can access this. And obviously, in a case like that, there's a question of specificity. Like, how do you do it so that it only hits the rheumatoid arthritis setting but doesn't hit other places where the immune system is using that same molecule for good? And in particular, also, it comes down to the woman at the back of the audience was pointing out that she actually had some experience with some of these drugs. It depends a little bit on the patient, right? So I should tell you that the drugs for cancer have a side effect in about 5% of patients. And I'll give you an example. Man walks into the clinic. He's a 60-year-old man. He comes into a friend of mine, Mark Anderson's diabetes clinic. And he's presenting with diabetes at age 60. Well, I should tell you that the frequency with which you see people first presenting diabetes at age 60 is very low. Most diabetes is of this kind, autoimmune diabetes, most people are about 16. It's called juvenile diabetes. Some of them are teenagers or youth. And he just had chemotherapy. He just had checkpoint blockade therapy where you de-repress the immune system. turns out that he probably should have gotten diabetes when a 16-year-old, like as a 16-year-old, his immune system managed to turn on these inhibitory circuits, preserve his pancreas. He didn't have diabetes for his entire life. He gets cancer. His immune system gets de-repressed, and all of a sudden the diabetes shows up. And so, again, it comes up to this question that that happened to some people that have that predisposition and dodged a bullet when they were younger. And so you're now de-repressing not only the immune system but cancer, but the immune system that in some ways has been protective of this liability that you've had your entire life. Then maybe you should have, you know, your body wanted to respond to this, whatever it was about your pancreas that was telling it, you know, you're supposed to destroy this. It was actually able to quell that until we released those brakes. So this is going to become a field as we start to understand it, where we need to think about the whole patient, what their genetics are, what their experience are, and what their likely side effects are given some of the types of liabilities that can be from genetics, they can be from experience, you know, your body's experience over years. And you had a point or a question.
Do you think the variability in the immune system between people end up being a predictive factor for disease, or...
Yeah, I do. I do. And I think there's kind of, so far, we don't have enough molecular data, but there's been longstanding connections between, one that's really interesting is this series of patients that get neurodegeneration where their immune system fails to function quite properly in here and then gets kind of a little jiggy and causes a disease called frontal temporal lobe dementia. Those patients also show autoimmunities. And we kind of haven't worried about the autoimmunes because an FTLD is much worse. And people, they die of that first. But as we're understanding the molecular basis for that, the same gene that's giving deficits to the immune system in the brain is also giving them propensity to autoimmunity. And the cool thing there, this is like cutting data from our lab, is that same gene in mice protects mice from cancer. You get a defect in it. You get sort of heightened the equivalent of autoimmunity, which is clearing the tumor. It also predisposes to frontal temporal lobe dementia. Where that happens, you'd prefer to have it only in the tumor but not in the brain. And so those are the tricks that we're going to have to figure out with drugs in the future, is to figure out, you know, where some of these tricks can be harnessed locally but not globally to make the immune system a little bit more active here but not there. And it's going to be tricky, but I think we're starting to understand the tricks that can be used. Yeah, so think about a fulcrum where the immune system can go two different directions. Most of the tumor microenvironment is pushing immunosuppression, and there's these good cells that we know are pushing activation. What we've managed to do in that particular case is figure out drugs that specifically target the immune system that's doing suppression and leave the immune system alone that we want to rise up. And it really is as simple as that. The idea of some of these drugs is very simple, is specificity. And here we're trying to find specific drugs for the immune system that are specific for the immune system that's the bad immune system. And the distinction is, of course, you know, to how do you know? And that's what we've been trying to figure out there. And what we have figured out is some molecules and some pathways that are very discrete and very distinct to the suppressive immune archetype and leave the other one alone. And the other one there, therefore, becomes it's like a weight thing. The immune system, I think, at some point makes a decision based on the weight of evidence. And if you basically relieve this, then this one seems weightier. And that's how we understand it. I think we need to finish, but thank you very much for coming. And I'm happy to answer questions for you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.